I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This time on The Art of Rave, I'm joined by Felix Buxton, one half of the legendary Basement Jacks. Over the last three decades, they've crossed Chicago and New York house with ragga, infused punk with garage, and managed to organise chaos in their six studio albums. From throwing raves in abandoned South London Mexican joints to the massively influential debut album Remedy, their Ibiza Glitterbox residency in between headlining Glastonbury and winning a Grammy and two Brit Awards, it's been a journey like no other. Basement Jacks, Felix Buxton, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Hello, everybody out there in the world. Hope you're breathing, smiling, living, loving, because we're all alive and we've got to celebrate this life.
This is going to be a good podcast, I can tell. Let me give you some background on my fandom and my fangirly moments of Basement Jacks. I remember my sister, my big sister, giving me her computer tower, probably back in 2005. So I'd have been 11, maybe 2004. And I remember she had bought Basement Jacks the singles. And that's where my love for Basement Jacks started. I remember listening to all of those tunes and knowing them all as well. It wasn't like any of them were like new to me, but it was like all of those songs that I'd heard over the last 10 years of being on this earth, kind of compiled into one amazing album. And then as I grew up, I think the album to do it for me was Scars back in 2009. And that was amazing for me because in 2009, I probably would have been about 15, 16. I can't do the maths. But I remember me and my friends listening to that. And my favourite song on that was actually the Paloma Faith tune, What's a Girl Gotta Do?
Oh, yeah.
I just loved how it was just something I'd never heard before in terms of it was an actual song, but it was on a very different, not like a pop production that you would ever hear. And I suppose it wasn't. And then you had the Sam Sparrow stuff and all of that. I fucking loved that album. And obviously it's kind of been a wide spread of albums for you. Can you tell me where it all started for you and where you met Simon and how this kind of incredible sound all started?
Well, I came to London in 91. So basically I left school in 1988, which was the summer of love, which was the time of Acid House. Musically, it was an amazing time. It was very open. House music was new. And it was, I remember in 1987, in the school break time, someone with a ghetto blaster playing a tape cassette, and we all stood around, and it was House Nation, and that's which was the House Master Boys, and it sounded so fresh, and it was kind of it was like a computer had gone wrong, and it just sounded like ridiculous, like a really different style of music, and that was really exciting, and So probably my love for dance music. Well, I don't know. I've always loved dance music. I used to love all doing the Okie Kokie, which is like we all do the Okie Kokie when I was 5 years old, probably. And I love Mozart and I love waltzes and Strauss and kind of gypsy music. And So I liked the Charleston and kind of 1930s music. I really like that. And probably because growing up, my dad was a vicar. And So Sunday lunchtimes, after we'd all been to church and I'd sang in the choir, me and my two sisters. And then he'd put old time musical music on, which was on the radio at that time. And sometimes if it was really good and the spirit took him, he'd get up and start having a dance around. And yeah, so it was kind of, dancing was quite natural. And it was kind of, yeah, him and my mum met at the Young Farmers dancing together. So it's kind of like, yeah.
Oh, that's so cute. That's how I suppose it was back in the day before all this horrible dating stuff that's online and Tinder.
Exactly.
And all
it was
of that.
Very, yeah. I mean, he said he saw her when he was 14 and he thought, oh, that's my wife. That's fine. So, but he thought, leave it a few. He was quite a mature kid, I think. And then a few years later, yeah. Anyway, that's by the by. But so my love of dance music was probably when I was first going out dancing when I was 17, and I learned to drive. I lived in the Midlands, and
you're East Midlands, right?
Leicester. I was born in Leicester, and I lived in a village in the countryside, Ibstock. There was a mining village, and then Woodhouse Eaves, which was like a posher village. So I got two kind of experiences, and. Yeah, which is good. But in when I turned 17, my mum got a car, so which I could use, this Winnie with a Mini with fat wheels, and which was important to me at that point. And so me and some friends, we drove to Leicester and to Nottingham. Nottingham, there was I never knew actually at the time, but Graham Park, who was very much part of the Manchester scene, he used to DJ there. I never knew who the DJ was wasn't important in those days, because often they'd be behind a wall and you couldn't even see them. Maybe they had a little cutout bit so that they could see what was happening or see if the lights were flashing or not.
Like a bird watching box.
Yeah, kind of. And in those times, also is Cool Cat in Nottingham as well, where they used to fill the whole place with smoke so you couldn't see at all in the dance floor. And then they'd put on the strobe. So it was kind of, it was basically like having a fit. And probably if you were likely to have epileptic fits, it was not the place to go. But and the smoke was banana flavour.
Banana-flavoured smoke.
Yeah, and that's where kind of acid dancing started, where people started putting their hands in front of the face like this.
Right.
Because actually they were looking at their fingers flashing in the smoke. And we didn't have any money really. So we had enough money to get in. We never bought a drink. At the end of the night, I used to go up to the bar and say, could I get a glass of water? Because I'm thirsty. which is really funny. And we danced like from, I suppose it opened at maybe 10 or 9:30 something. So we'd get on the dance floor and we wouldn't leave till 3:30 when the door shut because it was the
completely
music was
sober.
Yeah, completely sober. but you had all this smoke and the vibe was very good. And it was like maybe a club culture kind of exploded then as an
right.
idea. So definitely when I was in Leicester, a place called the Bear Cage, that I think it was their first acid party. And where every single record was acid house, which was very weird at the time. All nyep, 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 nyep. No one knew what to make of it, which was so exciting. And but I remember going there in Leicester Town Centre, and there was in those days. I mean, we talk about violence and how society is now, but I mean, there was like a gang in Leicester called the Baby Squad. They're all about 14. There'll be about 40 to 50 of them in a pack, and they all had knives. And I remember them kind of shouting wanker at me. And because at that time, if you were into clubbing and alternative culture, it was a definite kind of, it meant you were into peace and love and right. kind of, which wasn't cool on the football terraces until about 1988, when they all started doing pills. And that actually got rid of lots of violence. So, which I thought was kind of a new summer of love, kind of 1960s, and which was really exciting. And I went to uni in 88 and I started putting on parties with a couple of friends there, and I started this Peace and Love Society, which was the idea that we'd kind of dance for peace and love, just me and a couple of female friends that I met when we first got there, who I'm still good friends with now. And, yeah, so we did the psychedelic groove, but we didn't play any psychedelic music. We had some real hippies came and they were like, where's the psychedelic music, man? Well, we actually didn't really know what that was. We wanted to play acid house and hip hop. And so you'd play funk, hip hop, acid house, anything that was new. It didn't really matter what the genre was. There wasn't the idea that you had to be into a certain thing. And it was just very much about dancing. And probably then you'd see a lot of, like, also there was a jazz dance scene that was happening at the same time. So I used to go and do jazz dance, and you'd do the splits and pirouettes, and you'd try and outdance each other with jewels, kind of jazz jewels, like the Cotton Club, that was a film from maybe, I don't know, maybe the 1950s. But yeah, so that musically, that was a great time. And actually, if I think with my mum's Mini, one time, I think maybe one of the first times I got to drive it, and it wasn't my friends picking me up that I was actually driving. And I remember there, and I put on the radio, and I remember hearing DJ Easy Rock and Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock, It Takes Two. And it was so amazing because it was, it's woo, yeah, woo, yeah, really energetic.
And James Brown sample, right?
Well, it's from It Takes Two to Make a Thing Go Right. It's the Funky People. I'll tell you in a minute. I can't remember. Yeah, it's James Brown, Funky People, Lynn Collins, and yeah, I should know
this. Apparently,
I used to know
in
this.
My crib sheet, it says James Brown produced 1972 single "Think a Brackets About It" by Lynn Collins. Yeah, I think we should hear it. This is Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock. It Takes Two. The reason why, man, I don't know, so let's go, cause do you put this in your set still? Do you ever put this in?
No.
Do you not?
No. I mean, it all exists. Everything's available out there for anyone. You can listen to what you want, when you want. I mean, in those days when I first started DJing, which was in 1988, actually that was at uni in my first year. There was a charity party called No More Bullshit that this guy put on, and it was for blind awareness. And so basically I was asked to DJ. And I said, well, I don't have any records or anything. But they said, but you're really into music and dancing and everything. And so what I did was borrow records and tape cassettes. So I played one record, one tape cassette. And I could well have played that. I probably played the Lynn Collins one. But you try and play the hip-hop version and then you play the original sample together. So it kind of all joined all the dots. So I played the dance music, and the guy playing next was Tom York, Radiohead. So
no
he was
way.
Playing. He was playing the indie music.
Whoa! So let me just rewind. You were mixing from a cassette tape,
yeah,
and a vinyl,
yeah, and also I'd never done it in my life before. But people said all you have to do with DJing, you start one and then stop it and start another and try and blend the join. That's all DJing is. It's no big fancy thing.
Is it easier with hip hop then? Because is it easier to match up the beats or
probably drum and bass is probably harder because it's so fast. I don't know. Very slow music is a lot easier. Yeah,
right. Got you. So you were that's mad. So how old were you at this point? Like 18, 19?
18, 19, yeah.
So you've been going sober raving at 17, which I think is so easy to do when you're that age.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've been to many raves actually completely sober, drinking water all night just because I love the music. And I think if you're that into it at that age, all you want to do is kind of go out and be there all night and just enjoy the experience rather than getting off your tits and doing all of that.
Yeah.
Although that did come on, that did come later for me. But I think that's really interesting. So you got to uni, you started putting on this night, the Love and Peace Society.
Peace and Love Society, did the psychedelic groove. And then after I DJed, I thought, oh, I could do my own night and just play exactly the music I want to hear.
After your first DJ experience, you thought, oh.
So I thought, I need to find somewhere to do it, to play some music and make some posters, which I did. So I made the Natural High Club and did that at a place called Time Peace in Exeter. And then from there...
How come Exeter? Where were you at uni at the time?
Well, I wanted to go to university because I wanted to leave home, and that's what you did. And you could get a grant from the government in those days, so it was kind of, which was very good. So it actually paid for your accommodation, and it, for me, it was near the sea, and I'd noticed that the south coast seemed to have better weather when I watched the weather over the years. It was more sunshine, although I did later discover Exeter got a lot of rain. The proportion of girls to blokes was like 70 to 30 or something like that. And it was near the sea. So I thought that's the best place to go.
So
my time at Exeter, I did that. I started a True Groove radio show. Because it was a university radio that no one could really hear because the transmitter didn't really work very well. But there was a chance for myself and a housemate called Simon McCleave, who's now a crime author. That's what he does.
Wow.
So he was from London, so he knew a bit more about hip-hop and that side of things. So we did that together. And then, I was really into the whole thing. I was lucky enough, Soul to Soul came to the university in like 1990 or something. So I met all them. I was trying to establish who was the Funky Dread, and they were like, it's a movement, it's an attitude. And so that was great. And I met Frank Tope, who's been a friend and now is in the music industry. He like signed Franz Ferdinand he does Universal Publishing and stuff. But for many years, he was my guide to what's happening in London and particularly jazz music. And he's a friend of since then. And he'd come and DJ at the first Psychedelic Groove because he knew. And that's when I heard one of my favourite records, which is Can You Feel It, Mr. Fingers, which I'd recommend to anyone. If you want to know what Deep House is, that is basically it. The instrumental Can You Feel It, Mr. Fingers. After Exeter, I was in London. I got a job. I thought it was taking art exhibitions around Europe, but it was a PR company, and I got the job not knowing what PR was. But anyway, I wanted to go to London, went there and I met Simon, and that was kind of, I was doing some tracks. He was doing with like one guy I'd met, who was into trance. I wasn't so into trance. But he had some equipment. And then I met Simon through some friends of friends. Initially I went in with two other friends. We hired him and his mate who did something called Helicopter to engineer for us for a day. And they charged us something like £10 an hour.
Wow.
Which we thought was quite expensive, I think.
But
that was good, and that was kind of the beginning of kind of doing stuff. And I met Simon, and after doing a couple of these sessions, I said, he seemed to be able to work really fast, and kind of the ideas would come into reality quickly.
Right.
And I said, would you be up for doing a project based on American house and the kind of, I was really into the underground scene that kind of came out of New York and Chicago, around that time, 91, 92. And And he said yes, and that was kind of the beginning of Basement Jacks, which started in about 94. So 93, 94.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but probably it was to describe that whole New York sound and what kind of where it's coming from. Probably the record that I really fell in love with and that really kind of links me to the also the first time I did E, I heard this record at the end of the night as well. But I'd heard it first of all like dancing, and then next time when I was working as a landscape gardener in the holidays as a student. And they played it on Radio 1, which used to be quite good in the afternoons in the old day. It was not as kind of personality-led. It was more fun, I think. So, right. But that's society, isn't it? Everyone takes themselves a bit seriously nowadays. It's kind of like, you know, they're into their image quite a lot, you know, with the Instagram culture and everything.
Got you. Right. So yeah. It was more about the music back then than it yeah. was...
And actually, Steve Wright in the afternoon, he used to have comedy characters, so it was quite funny. So when we were all there landscape gardening, digging and chopping and mowing, me and my friends in Sheffield in the Sainsbury's car park area, and we had the radio on and we were listening to Frankie Knuckles' the Whistle Song, and we thought, and it was an amazing moment. We were all dancing there, kind of like mowing, chopping. It was the best. And then when I got...
In the car park, or is this landscape gardening?
No, in the kind of like grassy area around the car park. Yeah, so there were people going to do their shopping. But, so that was, and then, well, years later with Basement Jacks, I got to meet Frankie Knuckles, which was amazing. But also when I went to London to my first kind of underground rave, it was called Yellow Book, and Andrew Weatherall was DJing there. Frank, my friend, told me about this, and so I did some E, which was apparently very pure MDMA, which actually didn't feel like you were on anything. I just felt completely
really?
normal. But then the night finished, I was like, oh, I'm not tired.
So I can imagine with you actually, yeah. Felix, that ecstasy wouldn't touch the sides.
but anyway, the last record of the night was Frankie Knuckles' The Whistle Song. And he started, Andrew Weatherall, who passed away, rest his soul, last year, he played, it was Aretha Franklin's gospel album, like there was in the morning, some kind of very moving speech, and then this slowly glided out of it. And the Whistle Song, and I think it's a beautiful piece of music, and probably with Basement Jacks, that was the kind of thing I was trying to aspire to, something sophisticated with depth, with emotion, and it kind of seemed to be of a higher sensibility. It was like reaching for, you know, it was positive. There was a lot of positivity, and Frankie Knuckles was there at the beginning of House, which was all about unity and bringing, you know, whoever together from the fringes of society. So I really connected to that whole message, and this kind of record encapsulates Deep House that whole time for me. So this is Frankie Knuckles' The Whistle Song, and it's either the Eric Cooper mix or the Sound Factory mix. And the Sound Factory,
for me, Felix.
The Sound Factory was an amazing club in New York.
Okay, let's listen to it. Let me take it back a little bit. So you'd started up your own night in Exeter.
Mm-hmm.
How did that go?
Great. Yeah, some people came. We made, I don't know, we probably made some money. I made enough money to buy some more records to play at the next one.
So what was the, when was the first vinyl that, how old were you when you bought your first vinyl then?
Well, probably 11 with my sisters. That was one Christmas. And so we had to buy a record that all of us could like. And we bought an album by the Nolan Sisters, who were like some kind of feel-good sort of Irish trio. And they did Bridge Over Troubled Waters, which was a song we'd heard of, and some other songs. And so we decided we'd heard of the artist, and it was three women and my sister. So maybe I was the third woman in the group or whatever. So that was the first album. And I suppose probably because I grew up and I didn't have any money when I was young, which was fine. I'd get whatever I got from jumble sales because the church jumble sales would happen, but I'd always get in early because I was the vicar's son. So I could get the pick of the crop. So it's kind of, that's where I bought my AC/DC Back in Black album from. It was a bit warped. And the best disco album in the world, which I got at 11 as well, which I loved. And that was from a friend. His sisters, they were at the local garage and they said, we've got two copies of this record. So they gave one to me. So basically a lot of my life has been quite organic, just whatever happens.
Well, I tend to think that by the time you reach 11, because again, this is when my sister gave me the computer with your album on and many, many others, the singles, I kind of feel like if you're getting a musical intelligence at 11 years old, you know what your plan is. If you can feel music on an intelligent emotional level at 11, it's quite a telling sign that you're going to go on to do good things in music. So you obviously always knew that was destined for you then, I'm guessing.
No, not at all. When I went to London,
Why did you move to London?
In 91.
But why?
Why? Because London was where everything happened.
Right.
At the time, if you wanted to buy records, you had to go to... Well, when I was in Exeter, I got the train to Bristol because that was a main centre. And, you go to London or Nottingham or Leicester. Manchester was, like, happening a lot at that time. And actually, when I first met Tom York at university, he was the first person I met. And we were both like, oh, we're not sure about this Exeter place. We should have gone to Manchester because Manchester's really cool and where everything's happening. Yeah. But,
so it could have ended up anywhere, really. You could have ended up in Manchester, Bristol or London.
But I wouldn't go to London because it was too expensive for students. That seemed like a good move.
So you left uni, went to London.
Yeah.
Because you briefly mentioned you meeting Simon through some friends of yours.
From London. So through friends I knew at university, the guy I did the radio show, I've got three friends called Simon, and it was through the three Simons I met this other Simon, which is and you were talking about Glitterbox earlier, and that's Simon Dunmore. So the world seems, I'm surrounded by Simons everywhere.
So, because I've heard, right, so the Basement Jack Simon.
Yeah.
I've heard many stories. So I heard that you met on a Thames Riverboat party. I heard you met in a club in Clapham, in a pub in Clapham.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Which one?
The pub in Clapham. I think, yeah, that's what I think. Although I think he said that he met me before that, but I can't quite remember. I know then we definitely talked. And and he had some music equipment. So I was like, ding, that's kind of great. Yeah.
So when was the moment that you knew you guys were onto something? When did you start producing together or DJing together? How did all that start?
So I met him through some friends of friends. And then I asked him if he was up for doing this project that I wanted to do an EP and make music with this New York style. And he said, yeah, that sounds good. Let's do it. And then we'd meet every two or three months or something like that. And then we did that for a year. And I'd bring loads of currant buns, bananas and food to keep us going because I thought, well, you're going to need to...
You are adorable, Felix. Okay, so was this producing then, sorry, or was this mixing?
So I'd kind of bring lists of samples I had and write down on pieces of paper, like 3:21, a cough sample, you know, 5 minutes, a scream, you know, and get all the samples. We put them together. And that's when we made, so over that year, we made EP1. And I knew one guy who worked in the music industry. So I sent it to him. He worked at East West Records. And he was a DJ at university too. And anyway, I sent it to him. He's like, no, no, you know, it needs to be remixed, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, okay. And then there was Nervous Records in New York that I thought was really cool, and Strictly Rhythm. So they were basically the Basement Jacks logo at the beginning, which is like a face, Love Heart's face. It's a bit graffiti. So that was based on Nervous Records logo, because I thought that was really very cool. And a friend from Leicester, Joel, he did that.
Right.
And
you were very resourceful. You knew a lot of people that you could kind of call up and go, can you make me a logo? What do you think of this EP?
The thing is, nobody was anything like Joel. Like, we were making music. I met Simon. Simon had put one record out. So he'd done a white label with a couple of his friends, Jeff, which was in the basement where we did the first stuff.
Right.
And he'd actually done one, and it was like, but at the time also, I don't know, people made records. You just had to make one and then press it. I mean, that's all it was. And then you'd give it to people and try and persuade them to play it.
I was going to ask you about the pirate radio culture, and if that was a thing in your kind of... in your makeup, whether pirate radio was something. But I did wonder if it was or wasn't, because you were listening to stations over in the States, and obviously pirate radio, if I'm right, was kind of locally based from where the antenna was, right?
Yeah, but I listened to the Benji Candelario mix show, but that's Choice FM, which was based in Streatham or Brixton.
Okay, and he was...
But they, he so was he playing. Used to send probably a tape over to them, a DAT tape or something, and they'd play the Saturday night mix show live from New York. So, I mean, right. it wasn't live from New York, but it sounded so good and sophisticated compared to what was playing around. I mean, there was Kiss FM in London was happening. In the Midlands, there was something like Rave FM or something like that, and that was kind of all kind of hardcore, like, rave scene, which is another thing that I was into.
Hardcore? And
it was kind of rave. It was called hardcore back in the day, but basically it was like jungle, drum and bass, the beginning of all that. So,
right. I suppose the hardcore that I grew up on wasn't anywhere. I suppose I was happy hardcore. I hit that kind of era. So I'm guessing.
Yeah, well,
that was
kind
like
of
that.
One strand. That went into several strands. It became kind of jungle. It became kind of. And anything that was what was really nice at the time. Genres were quite fluid. Like when I started DJing, often I wanted to try and get hip house music because I thought that was the best, because I liked the rapping and I liked house music. And but often the rapping was pretty bad, kind of a bit like modern music, actually. We've gone full cycle. And I think actually a lot of the hip hop house artists kind of faded away because the lyrics weren't good enough generally.
Right.
Probably the first track, Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock, that was you'd play that with house music. So it was kind of like you'd mix it all together, and De La Soul and various other artists around there. But the hardcore, this whole rave thing, so that was happening alongside a jazz dance scene and this stuff from New York. So, and probably in 91, I think that's when I went to my first, probably my only outdoor rave in the countryside, which was, it was called Rain Dance, and which was absolutely amazing. I remember me and my friend, I don't know, maybe we must have been maybe 20, I don't know, perhaps. But we were lying on the floor because we'd never thought of doing that before. We did some ecstasy. So this was the second time I did ecstasy, because I'd done it in London, and I said to my friends, you've got to try this. This is amazing. And
Illegal rave or an illegal rave?
They had a big marquee and tent. So I mean, I guess it was legal, but
okay.
I mean...
So it wasn't like you were finding the address on a telephone box somewhere or...
It wasn't quite that kind of undercover, although we did have to find out where it was. It was meant to be in a field somewhere, like, right, in that direction. So it probably took us a while to get there. And it was great. You'd walk over these hills and then you'd go down into a valley. So obviously some farmer had said, yeah, I'll take a load of money. You can have my land, which is just like Glastonbury or whatever.
Yeah.
And yeah, and there was a huge tent there, and that was probably it, actually, just a huge tent. And then kind of some little area you had to get in. And yeah, so probably a record to describe that. Also, the Prodigy, Charlie Says, that song was around at that time. So they were just kind of developing. Right. And the record I remember from that rave is called Midi Rain Eyes. And yeah, and it just typifies the kind of, I don't know, it's kind of a bit mystical, a bit deep, but it's a, I don't know, mixes urban and ethereal kind of, but it...
Very much so. You're totally right, actually. We should listen to it, Midi Rain. The first album, Remedy, in 99, because that isn't house music at all, is it really? It's very eclectic, and you kind of put your own label on it. I think I've got in my notes here that it was Punk Garage that you called it. So tell me all about this. Tell me how it got signed and tell me how it kind of became what it became.
Well, the name Punk Garage, that came from my friend Frank. Because after the Taco Joe's, we did a couple of, basically just kept doing it in different venues in Brixton. And the George IV seemed like a good space, and which was up Brixton Hill. And we also did it in a crypt and got this guy I found from Essex who had these enormous Function One speakers, which were like, the quality was amazing. So, because again, I was trying to emulate what I imagined the Sound Factory in New York was, and the Ministry of Sound opened around, I can't remember, that around that time, and these American DJs like Benji Candelaro and Tony Humphries, they came over. So I got a chance to see them, and I'd go dancing there till it shut at 9:30 a.m.
Wow.
And actually, they opened, they had no alcohol as well. So because in New York they had no alcohol, which was like, which is quite interesting. And yes, people did do drugs, but, and some people didn't. It's kind of, you had hardcore dancers who went to dance. So it was kind of a slightly different thing than, definitely rave culture happened. Some people really got into drugs and rave, and, you know, the Sun newspaper sort of said, we're all doomed, this is the end. But I mean, definitely people like me and a lot of people I'd meet had a pure love for it. And also kind of the message in the music from Chicago and the States, it was kind of, I mean, people often play like an a cappella. Jack is the one who gave us the key to the house. Is like, you may be black, you may be white, you may be Jew, you may be Gentile. It doesn't matter in our house. And Jack had the groove. And it was all about, house was all about this safe space where you could be whoever you wanted to be. It kind of like, it very much came from the gay scene in America. That's why actually, when we first went as Basement Jacks over to America, they said, we're a bit confused with your music because it's kind of like black music and it's like white music, but and then it's like pop music and it's like, and we don't know which genre to put you in. And we were like, well, this is really stupid. And it made you realise how segregated America was in its thinking.
Yeah, I bet.
And,
it's the same sort of thing over here as well, right? I'd have said.
Not as much. I mean, the thing is, probably the underground club scene was very, very mixed. It was kind of, it was about expressing yourself. If you're into fashion, you dress really fashionably. If you're gay and you wanted to express your gayness, that's... I don't know, it didn't really matter. And I think what was amazing about probably acid house and the rave culture at the time going out, there was this whole feeling that you'd go out and you'd meet everyone at the club and, yeah, it's like, oh, that one's a bricklayer, that one's going to be a doctor. I don't know, And that was really invigorating, that you're meeting people different than yourself. So it's kind of, and it was allowed at that point. I don't know.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Do you think that, because from my experience of raves and parties, I don't necessarily feel like that include. I think it's come round now, and I think this is why the importance of glitter boxes should have been really prominent in rave culture anyway. But I'm really happy that something like glitter boxes back round that celebrates, you know, different races and different sexualities and stuff. But do you feel like that was sort of lost in the mid-noughties?
Well, definitely, probably when we started doing Basement Jacks in like 94, 95, I wanted to do something that had the spirit of a few years before, because it definitely felt like club music, definitely cocaine arrived.
Right.
And also club promoters started getting greedy, charging a lot to get in. And probably in 88 to 91, a lot of it was, I mean, with me putting on parties, you'd get a bit of money, but it wasn't, money was only so you could buy records to put on the parties. And so you could afford some spray paint to make some banners to make the place look really amazing. So it was kind of, and probably with Basement Jacks, that was never about making money at all. It was kind of, right. I thought that, because the music I was into was not fashionable. It was kind of it was an underground. It was really cool. And it was I loved it. But it wasn't mainstream at all. So probably when Remedy happened, that and Daft Punk as well, because we kind of when they first came to the UK and did their tour,
you supported them, right?
Yeah. So and they were into the same, you know, they liked Armin van Helden and Sneak and the Chicago stuff. So we kind of shared a mutual love of this kind of this scene, and it felt it was, we were called the Mongoloids, which is like Junior Sanchez in New York called this group. Well, basically, he probably thought it might rub off on all of them, but which was ourselves. And then there was Ian Pooley from Germany, Daft Punk from France, and then Armin van Helden, DJ Sneak, Roger Sanchez. So there was this posse that were really into house music and hip-hop and underground music and about being radical with the way you made it. So you were trying to break the formula and just say, look, I'm doing this. And like, wow, you did that. That's so in a way, it kind of pushed the envelope. And I mean, definitely Masters at Work, Louis Vega and Kenny Dope, they were a massive influence. And Mood to Swing were another name from the New York sort of sound.
Armin van Helden has a big prominence in my kind of growing up as well. NYC Beat and there's another tune that he did that was very commercial, but I was into that kind of commercial dance 2005-06 sound. Mm-hmm. And he actually, what did he say about you guys, that you took house music and fucked it up the arse? Is that
exactly?
That...
It's very American crude style, like quote. Yeah, but I mean that's I mean it's punchy and had impact. But basically, yeah, he was saying that we were kind of messing with the formula because it, you know, there was music probably after the main innovation, probably about when we started Basement Jacks. A lot of people started being a bit generic and formulaic with what they were doing. So as a result, it became less alive. You know, of course, youngsters coming up, it was all new for them or whatever. But yeah, it seemed like we'd passed, and this the hope I had that we were kind of this new peace and love generation, the Generation X. I thought that was so exciting that it seemed to have faded a bit. It was we weren't going to change culture completely. And the football hooligans who started doing E and are not fighting anymore, like, I don't know, they started doing coke, there was a bit of trouble, there was, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so things kind of changed a bit. But that's probably when we were doing Basement Jacks in the kind of around that time and Daft Punk, we kind of created the next bit. And there were a lot of people like us and that were, you know, that we were inspired by, definitely like... I mean, Armin van Helden, we heard that he'd heard our record in New York and that he really loved it and he thought it was Be Free was the track. And then later, I think it was maybe meeting him a couple of years later and like, wow, you're Armin van Helden. He said, yeah, I love it. It's so European. And we're like, oh no, because that was kind of like the kiss of death, really, because the first record, we got shrink-wrapped, so it looked like it came from America.
Right.
Because to me, the records I wanted were all imports. They were shrink-wrapped, and they were the quality ones. So it's kind of, which is a bit kind of, yeah, it's probably being into the whole thing, which, you know, DJs were, because they were trying to get the good tunes, and we had, you know, Louis Vega from, he was for the... Samba Magic, our track, he left a message on my house in Herne Hill. And Fiona, who I ran the parties with at the beginning, she said, check the answering machine. Because on the sending out the record to him, I'd put these kind of my telephone number as, you know, if you want to get in touch with the office, go there. and there was a message and it says, yo, this is Louis Vega from the Sound Factory in New York. Your record is slamming. And it was like, oh my God. And that was so not long after that, that's when I got made redundant. I thought, okay, give the music a go. I'd worked out I had 6 months before I'd have to go back and live with mum and dad. So it was kind of like I had enough money to last for 6 months. So I thought I'd try the music for 6 months. And that was in maybe 96, 97. And yeah. And actually it just carried on from there. And then XL Records, they came very early on. We had a record called Fly Life, which was signed. That went out as a single. I can't quite remember the time, but basically Nick Worthington was a guy who came from XL. He'd come to our club nights and he'd stand at the back, and we got a meeting with him. He got us to have a meeting, I think, and said, you know, how about you guys doing an album? And we were like, why would we do an album? You know, we're making kind of these dance records. I mean, it's a nice idea, but we met this singer, Karina Joseph. We could make her, she could be the singer, so maybe she'd be the artist and we could create the songs.
The sound for her, right.
Yeah, and Karina was at my friend Fiona's work, and it was like she used to do the photocopying there, and Fiona said, yeah, this girl at work, Karina, sings, she can hold a tune, she's got a nice voice, people really like her voice. So she ended up being the first like vocal song we did, which was like one of our first EPs, and it was called Karina Joseph. And
called your EP her name?
Well yeah, she was the artist because she was singing.
Very
so,
cool. Very yeah, very yeah. cool.
And yeah, so we thought we could make her a star and we'd be the producers. We'd be like these New York producers, whatever. And
New York producers from Leicestershire.
Yeah, exactly. And Simon was born in Holland, and yeah,
oh, really?
So Yeah, so, which is always, they said, we're the boys from Brixton, which always used to annoy me. I love Brixton. It's a great place. And I lived there for, I don't know, 25 years or 20 years or something. But, yeah, but I always said, no, I'm from Leicester. I was born in Leicester. But the yeah, media and press, they like to have an idea of what you are. The parties were in Brixton. Right. I wanted to do them in the West End, but I couldn't afford it.
Of course you did.
Yeah,
I love that. I love how inclusive this whole story is and how conscious you've been throughout your career to lift other, not only people, but women and different people from different cultures and races and religions. I think that, and sexualities, I think that is the coolest fucking thing, because I suppose in my experience of working with other producers and being a featured vocalist and, you know, wanting to be in the video and wanting to progress my own artist career, I've found it very difficult, and I very much found a, no, thank you for the song, thank you for the voice, but we don't want you a part of our creative. So it's so refreshing to hear, you know, that it was such an important thing for you.
Well, but that's really, it's putting the truth out there, isn't it? Because it's like, I do think it's a bit lame how the last few years that you'll hear some full-on vocal song and it's like by, you know, Gary someone, whatever, and there's a picture of some, like, bloke.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, how much did he do? He did like some beat loops and put a bit of a warp bass.
Exactly. Got and it someone, from and taken Slice.
Some and taken some vocalist, and I think that's kind of But anyway, all these things are getting changed, you know, which is like people are waking up to it, which is brilliant. And
they are.
Culture always swings one way and then the next. You know, something, I mean, dance music became very commercialized. And we're part of that happening, and we're very lucky. Thank you very much. I feel very grateful and blessed to have been part of it.
But, you had the talent to back it up, and that's been so evident and has shown, and it's shone through more than anything else.
But also more than anything, being prepared to work for hours and hours and hours. Like at the end, when I was still at the office, I'd sometimes work nearly all night with Simon on tracks, and then I'd go to the office and I'd be so delirious. And but it was fine, because also I met printers there. I learnt about printing and for printing the records. I photocopied all the things for the press sheets there, typed them up, and my friend Fiona, she managed to get a lot of the flyers printed out at her end as well. So we were all just like, we would work was helping us to do our fun and our creativity and kind of build things.
So I'm guessing the Gorilla Suit era was such an incredible fun. And from what I've gathered over speaking to you over the last hour and a half, I feel like dancing is so important to you. And that's so lovely to hear from somebody who makes music and DJs music, is that actually it's the vibe that it, and the feeling that it gives you. Is that live set that you did with the Gorilla Suit, was that kind of like a pinnacle of, this is exactly where I saw the Jacks going, or how did it all come around? Tell me.
I mean, everything was like a slow kind of trajectory, probably, is and was all quite organic in the way that it built. So we DJ'd in Italy, and then they were interested in our music in America, like in the underground scene, and then the UK came next. The UK were a bit snobby and less welcoming, which it's funny in music that they're, hopefully it doesn't exist so much now, but it's kind of, there's enough for everyone, and it's kind of not a, it's a competitive attitude probably, and trying to like step on someone else's head or whatever. But so probably doing that, we did, when we were doing the first album, that probably XL said, oh, you should do a live show. And we were like, well, we DJ, but we don't like play live. And they say, it's fine, you can just kind of DJ. and have some, you know, so like you do at the George the Fourth and the club. Because I always used to get people and friends to join in if there was someone walked in and said, I can rap. We're like, there you go, there's a mic, rap. And I had a friend from school, she came one time and she said, oh yeah, I want to do my performance walking. And so she just did slow walking across the stage. That was her thing. And George Batista, who ended up being our percussionist at the beginning, I met him through a girl I'd met on the tube at the Brixton riots, because the tube stopped at Stockwell and didn't get all the way to Brixton. And I met this girl and she was Brazilian. We were chatting, you know, oh, what's going on? Is it safe? Blah, blah, blah. And then, the first Karina Joseph song, Lonely, basically the words were about her, because I met her and I fell in love with her, this girl that I'd met. And then You Made Me Lonely is a song. Because a week later she said, I'm moving back to Brazil. But actually all the Brazilian connection that was made over, like, Brazilian dancers, the percussion, that was all through her. And then, like, and George was a friend of hers, and George used to come and play percussion at the clubs, and then he toured with us to Japan and all over the world.
Wow.
And he was good at capoeira, so he'd end up doing, like, all these capoeira and he loved taking his top off and, like, doing backflips and walking on his hands, and all the girls going, oh! So that was great. So he was a character, and probably the live shows, the idea was to reflect the music, which is kind of... We're human beings interacting. So if someone's got a talent, hopefully they can show that and whatever it is, you know. And probably if someone dances, like, oh, have you ever tried flamenco dancing? Could you maybe do flamenco for that bit for Rendezvous? Wow. Yeah, a bit like this, and like, yeah, that'll do, a bit more like this, and we just kind of make it up. And probably the live show... That grew so slowly, and then the music, people got to know it, Remedy came out. And what you said about the kind of inclusion, I mean, the Remedy cover and the name, for me, was very much about that. And Remedy, the title, that came up from another friend who was really into music called Finbar, and he was quite good with words. So I think we had Universal Panacea or something like that. That's where we got to. It was kind of like... basically Remedy said it, but the music heals and kind of, it's kind of the positive aspect. And the cover was different coloured bodies lying together, because I thought it'd be really good to make it look like a landscape, so that we're all, and you can't see who's who, but we're all different flesh and they're all together.
Wow. But you're all in there.
Actually, George was in there, and that was one of the most embarrassing moments. So Rankin, the photographer, he was going to do the cover, which was like, wow, he's a top guy. We got a top guy to do it. So I remember going to his studio and he said, so what we talked about, yeah, so the bodies are lying inside these curtains in the middle of the office. And he said, well, so how do you want them? Do you want to go and arrange them? How you want them? And I remember just going so bright red, and I walked in. I was like, oh, hello, George. And he was there naked, lying in front of me. I was moving his leg and his shoulder, and then the girl next to him, there were breasts and penises and just like...
Didn't know where to look.
Yeah, exactly. And and then at the end of that process, actually, one thing I was unsure about, because Rankin thought he showed a little bit of breast and a face, which I was unsure about, because I like the fact that it's kind of more anonymous. But, I mean, he was probably right. He wasn't, yeah, you know, that's the picture that he took, so. So you were saying about how things got bigger and bigger.
Yeah, so by 2003...
The live shows got bigger and bigger. We got asked to go to different countries. We said yes and did everything the best we could. And if there was chance to have more budget or for anything, then it meant, oh, we could maybe have two more dancers or some brass players or...
Or fucking Prince Harry in one of the gorilla suits.
Yeah, that was at Hyde Park. So
wow.
So, well, the gorilla actually started because Rooty, the cover, was a gorilla called Capito, who was in the zoo in Barcelona. And he was an albino gorilla. And I went to see him in the zoo. I mean, at the time, he was there eating some poo. It was really sad. I'm not sure about zoos, whether we should have them at all. But he was a beautiful animal. They said that in the wild that he'd been attacked because he was different than all the other gorillas. And I thought it's interesting that he's white and he's an outsider in a black community. I have to be very careful talking about this nowadays. But I suppose more than anything, it's the idea that we make assumptions over the way someone looks, the way someone is, and being an outsider, maybe being a vicar's boy for me, I always felt like I wasn't into football. I thought that was tribalistic and kind of like, I don't know. Well, it was about violence often, so that didn't kind of relate. In Leicester anyway, it was. But the gorillas came from that probably because we had the gorilla on the cover. Matt Maitland, an amazing artist. This postcard I had. Whoops. this postcard that I had of the gorilla, he took that. He got it airbrushed by a guy in Germany. So there's so many layers to the creative process. And then the gorilla became associated with where's your head at and the whole thing. So I can't remember because initially we had a couple of stormtroopers as well that were like a bit like Planet of the Apes. So they were kind of, when we had brass players, they used to, for where's your head at, they'd put on the stormtrooper outfit. So it's like people would try different bits, but it seemed to kind of the wildness and also nature has always been a big theme. We did Back to the Wild and kind of like, this connection or not connection to nature, which I think is really important. And that's, if you look at Extinction Rebellion and everything going on, it's all about what are we doing to this world, living selfishly, greedily. But the gorillas came from that. And each time any friend or someone who wanted to do something would say, oh, do you want to be a gorilla? So we've had lots of people, Mike from the streets and...
Yeah.
I can't remember. Robbie Williams did want to do it. I can't remember if we let him in the end or not. I think he must have done it. Maybe. Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, well, we were generous enough. And then Prince Harry did it at Hyde Park.
That's very cool. I heard you rugby tackled him.
Well, he came and I think he wanted to meet Dizzy Rascal most. That was kind of on his hit list. Right. So he met Dizzy and we were there. And I met him and I remember, there were a couple of like side bodies with him. I said, oh, hi, nice to meet you, blah, blah, blah. They said, oh, are you Australian or Swedish or something? I said, no, I'm English. And they were being like really offish and weird with me, which I don't know why. And they were being quite Hooray Henry-ish. And Harry said, don't listen to those pricks. And I thought, good for you. He kind of cut them dead. And he was really nice and really straightforward. I can't remember if he probably met members of the band. And it was just very gracious and good. But I said to him just after speaking to him, I said, you know, if you want to be a gorilla on the stage, it's fine. You know, just let our crew know. And then I forgot about it completely. And then when Where's Your Head At was on and I was there performing it, singing, I can't remember if it was Rhonda or Cassie at the time, who was my sidekick. We were kind of, we'd always like fake wrestle and kind of jump around and just go quite bonkers. which my sister actually had a bit, she saw a clip of this. And she said she was ashamed when she saw her brother kind of like, you know, throwing some woman around on stage. And I was like, oh no. But, and I said, the whole message of the song is like, who are you? What are you doing? And it's like, it's kind of like theatre. But anyway, in Hyde Park, this gorilla came on, and I always, the brief for the gorilla was, you try and get into the part a bit. Don't just be like someone on stag do, kind of doing like disco dancing or whatever. And anyway, so this time it was there was a bit of a stag do gorilla, and I was like, that can't happen. So I went over and knocked the gorilla down because I was, you know, messing with nature. And then and then at the side of the stage, I saw someone with a kind of
little earpiece.
Security,
take him out, take him out.
And I was like, oh no! And then I realised, and so it probably stroked him or something. Yeah. And and then afterwards, coming out after the show finished, I saw the wardrobe girl Molly, and she looked very, she was beaming from ear to ear because he'd just taken off his trousers in front of her in this little curtained off area. And I saw him and I said, oh, so sorry. I mean, the sad thing was I did a kind of semi-curtsy.
Yeah, I've got this in my notes.
It was, which was, you know, I don't know where that came from. That's probably growing up in watching the Queen's Speech every year or whatever all your life. But anyway, I said, sorry. And he said, I had the best fun of my life just then.
Oh, bless.
And I thought, how great, you know. So
that is great.
Yeah.
Well, look, Felix, I could actually physically talk to you for hours. I find you very, very fascinating, and your passion and enthusiasm for music is infectious. I will tell you a little, I've got a rap now, but I will tell you a little story that when I was on, this is what I was saying, which is how I met Vula.
Yeah,
I was on The Voice in 2012, and I actually asked to sing Good Luck by you guys. And it was the track that kept me in the live shows for another week. And it was a bit iconic because I had this long cable that people were having to pull along the entire stage. But I had so much fun singing this. And it is a very big, important track in my life. So let's listen to Good Luck. And then I'll ask you my final question. Podcast is all about how rave has changed over the years, and you have definitely I was born in 94, so you guys were together even before I was kind of considered. So how, my last question, how does it feel influencing the next generation, and how do you think rave has changed?
I think more than anything, I've really felt this the last year or so, we seem to be back in like 88, 89. And it's quite interesting with the pandemic that people have been doing free parties and raves have been happening in the countryside. And the music is the same.
Yeah.
It's kind of like acid has all come back. And actually the mentality of what rave was then, of kind of like, who cares about the system? It's like, we want to be together and express ourselves. And it's a strong feeling. It's kind of like, and for me, probably with the Basement Jacks thing, and always music, it has to have like a strength of presence. You have to be connected to it. And I think a lot, it feels like there's a bit of a move away from the produced perfect kind of world, and to get something a bit rawer, that seems to be coming back, which is great, you know. And you know, for the young people now, yeah, take life and just kind of and live and don't be kind of told what you can't do. I mean, the whole Basement Jacks thing, like, so many doors were shut, but we just did it anyway. And slowly people came on board, but it's probably, 94 to 99. It took 5 years before people were listening. But those 5 years were probably the best.
Yeah, I bet.
So it's kind of like, and I remember every party, it just felt like it couldn't get any better. And we had people who'd been drawn to it who were really into the vibe and the ethos and and I think having vibe and ethos is, that's maybe one thing that's disappeared. It's like, it's kind of having principles as of who you want to be as a human being and what you do in the world, putting them in the middle of what you do and kind of, it gives you strength, I think. And which is definitely listening to your heart and saying, this is how I truly feel. They might all be doing that. Who cares? They will die. You will die. You know, live your life.
Well, Felix, it's been an absolute honour and pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on The Art of Rave. Basement Jacks, everybody, thank you so much.
The Art of Rave is presented and written by me, Becky Hill. It is a Strawberry Blonde production for my record label, Echo Records.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.